This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello there and a very good afternoon to you. Today, a local advocacy group says there is still time and strong public support to overturn the state government's decision to ban commercial demersal fishing along a long stretch of the WA coast. Phil Clark from Fish for All will be here after 12:30. And one of Australia's largest family-owned marine towage companies, Esperance-based Mackenzie Marine and Towage, has just been sold to a Spanish company. And for Fudd Mackenzie, whose dad started the business, this has been a time for reflection and putting pen to paper to write a book about his early years and experience as a former mariner, fisherman and tugboat captain.
I think I like fishing. Driving a tug is an amazing experience, as anybody who has ever done it tell you. It really is. Once you master that, it's a pretty amazing experience. But I think the thrill of catching fish and see, we were shark fishing mostly in those days. It was hard work, but I did enjoy it. But then tuna came along, and that was exciting. That was adrenaline pumping. You know, we all ended up with arms like Popeye, as I say, because we were pretty fit. We had to be pretty fit. Yeah.
You will meet Fudd a little later in the hour, 12:06 here on the Country Hour. A handful of Western Australian grain growers are still harvesting, taking off the remains of a record crop, which is definitely going to reach and likely to exceed 26.5 million tonnes. Now, the previous record was in 2022. With 25 million tonnes in the bin. Robert Kitto is from Mullawar, 445 kilometres north of Perth in the state's Midwest. He farms 12,000 hectares, half of which is wheat, and the other half is divided between canola and lupins. He started harvest on the 26th of October and finished just this week. So that's about 11 weeks of harvesting, one of the longest and latest finishes to harvest in his career. Rob, how did you feel as you completed that very last run?
Belinda, it was. I always get the same sort of feeling at the end of harvest or at the end of seeding, and you sort of look back and you go, oh, another couple of weeks, this wouldn't be too bad. But, you know, you've just got to look at reality and say, well, it's been a big season. Everybody's given it 110% to get us over the line when we do. And, you know, you can't just keep punishing people, you know, having them locked up in machines for another couple of weeks.
So is this the longest and the latest harvest you've ever experienced? I mean, because you've been there a long time. It's over 40 years or so, isn't it, Rob?
I left school and came home and worked on the farm at the end of 1982. Worked alongside my parents for quite a few years, and then you know, myself and my wife have been farming in our own right for quite a few years now as well. As far as I can remember, yes, it is. We pushed pretty hard to try and get finished before Christmas, before the Christmas break, because there's all sorts of other issues that come up over Christmas with vehicle movement bans. And probably one of the biggest issues that we have, we do employ quite a few casual staff, and our staff like to go home for Christmas. So when we employ them sort of in October, you know, we talk about a finish date, and our general average finish date is sort of like that third week of December. And we sort of say to them, look, if you can book a ticket for the round about the 20th, the 22nd of December, then we should be pretty close to being finished. And if we're not, well, that's on me, and I just have to do the best I can once you've gone home. Because, you know, family's important, Belinda, and we won't deny any of these guys the right to, you know, go home and spend the time with their families.
So you've got that sort of interruption when you're making those allowances for people to go and spend the festive season with family and friends. Did you have any other issues through the season? I mean, fires or mechanical breakdowns that contributed to, you know, that long harvest that you've just finished?
As far as mechanical breakdowns go, yeah, we did have a very good run as far as that goes. A few little hiccups here and there. Yeah, we run four harvesters and a couple of tractors and chaser bins and that sort of thing. But generally all the equipment went reasonably well. I think probably one of the biggest downfalls for us this year. And I know, and I keep going over this in my mind, you know, there's a lot of farmers that were finished way before we were and probably had the same size programs, if not bigger. And not sure why we were so slow. But CBH, they got inundated with trucks because, you know, a lot of farmers realised they were going to have a big year, so they bought extra machines and got extra trucking in to, you know, to meet that capacity. And they're sort of bottlenecked in at CBH. And, you know, I think a lot of us sort of expect CBH to pull a rabbit out of a hat and just say, yeah, sure, you know, like we'll just keep taking the trucks for as much as we possibly can. But when there's, you know, there was a few issues as well with quality this year after the bit of rain that we had at the start and that sort of thing. So, you know, CBH, I think, did the best they could with what they had to work with on a short-term basis type thing. And, you know, we normally get, say, 4 loads a day into the port from our farm per truck. And this year they were down to 3 loads a day, which was a big day for them. And a lot of times we were back to 2 loads a day per truck. And our contractor, he does have a lot of trucks, but he's got a few other clients that sort of he's got to share his trucks around. So, yeah, we did lose a bit of time with short days as well.
So that has a big impact on your productivity then?
Yeah, look, Belinda, it probably did. And when I haven't sat down and done the math on it, but yeah, we probably lost maybe 2 weeks of harvest time, which would have put us finished at about the, you know, before Christmas, about the 20th of December. But it's one of those things that we've just got to sit back and relax and enjoy the ride. And, you know, when things are out of your control, there's no point in jumping up and down and sort of expecting somebody to do something when everybody's working at capacity. And sometimes you just have to go with the flow and enjoy it.
Well, there are certainly signs of, you know, different options popping up here and there and growing competition in WA's grain industry. And we did see the first shipment of wheat to depart Geraldton independent of the CBH group last year, sort of around about mid last year, I think it was. It took a couple of years of planning, but a group of farmers and Andrew Young of Plum Grove Logistics successfully sidelined CBH and loaded nearly 7,000 tonnes of wheat using a mobile conveyor at the Geraldton port. And we've seen that at other ports too around WA. Are you supportive of that competition coming into the market?
Yeah, Belinda, we had grain on that shipment last year, and it worked. In the end, it worked out okay. There's a lot of hurdles to jump, and I think people who decide to go and do this are very, very brave, because, you know, there's a lot of compliance that needs to be met, and some of it is sort of unnecessary compliance because it's just a lot of red tape that needs to be cut to sort of get to the end of the goal, to the prize of what you need. For certain reasons this year, we didn't contribute with the Plum Grove thing this year, but hopefully next year we will be back in there. I don't think any of us are sort of upset with the way CBH and that do things, because, like, when you think about it, CBH has got to handle a lot of grain and they've got to be able to do it in a matter of 6 or 8 weeks. And it's very easy for somebody else to come along and say, oh, we can do it better. But, okay, the people who come along and say we can do it better, are they going to receive all grain? And it's okay if somebody comes along and says, oh, yeah, we're just going to specialise in ASW9 or lupin or canola or whatever. You know, that's fine, but CBH has got to handle all grain that's grown. You know, that's part of their charter. And it becomes bigger than Ben-Hur at the end of the day compared to some of these guys who are doing their boutique shipping.
This is the Country on the ABC, Western Australia. 14 past 12. Rob Kiddo is here today. He's a grain grower from Mullawar in the state's Midwest and has just finished harvest. It's probably his longest and latest harvest on record. And That's understandable considering the state's on track for a record crop of over 26.5 million tonnes. Now, Rob, there's a lot of speculation about the possible corporatisation of the CBH cooperative, the state's main grain handler. The CBH group says it has not received or provided any proposals regarding corporatisation, but the rumour mill keeps turning. Would a corporate takeover of CBH be something that you would be interested in and win your vote?
Belinda, look, I'm sort of like, I'm probably a bit of a fence sitter when it comes to this sort of thing. I do like the cooperative structure of CBH that, you know, like we're all grain growers, all grain growers in WA, we rely on CBH to handle our grain and try and keep the price as under control as possible and all that sort of thing. So I'm in the Geraldton Port Zone, and Geraldton Port Zone help the people in Kwinana Port Zone who help the people in Albany Port Zone or Esperance or vice versa. You know, like we all help each other because at the end of the day, we're all grain growers and not everybody can farm within 100 kilometres of the port. And some people choose to farm inland, some people choose to farm coastal, but it's up to, you know, organisation like CBH to keep that cooperative structure in place to sort of help everyone. And I think if CBH receival and handling goes to whoever has got the most money to sort of do whatever it is they want to do, I think the outcome will be very, very different for a lot of grain growers, because whoever's going to buy, if CBH was for sale, like I don't even know if it is for sale or whatever, you know, we're just talking hypotheticals, I guess, at the moment. But you know, if CBH was to be sold, it's going to be sold for a very, very big number. And whoever makes that investment is going to be looking for a very big return on investment, as people do when they invest in something. And I just feel that it's going to be to the detriment of the farmers farming further inland where they've got to pay a lot of freight and do all those sorts of things. But I think it's really a bit too early to really understand how all that could work. And I sort of think, me personally, these are my thoughts. I think that perhaps CBH, if it's going to be sort of disbanded a little bit and sold off, maybe receival and handling needs to be kept as a cooperative, and then all the other side of CBH needs to be sort of like maybe on the open market, perhaps.
Okay, with, listed.
You know,
a listed company.
Yeah, a listed company with a fair bit of farmer shareholders, or a lot of that shareholding offered to farmers, say, you know, like basically as a thank you for your contributions over the last however many years.
All right. Well, we'll watch this space on that because, you know, as you said, it is just speculation at this point, but there's certainly a lot of talk about it at the moment. Now, we didn't get to the really important point of the conversation today, Rob. How did the crop perform for you this season?
Belinda, look, we're very happy with, you know, the way the crop went and the yields and, you know, probably the best yields that we have seen in a long, long time, probably ever, actually, over a big area of our program. I haven't sat down and done the financial numbers on it yet or anything like that, but I'm pretty sure we'll get enough to do it all again this year, Belinda.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. I mean, it's a record crop this year, which is fabulous to hit a record like that. But the grain prices certainly aren't there like they were with the previous record. What, back in 2020?
2022. We basically, and I don't know what it was like for the rest of the state, but, you know, like up here in the Midwest area, it was a very good season for us up here in 2022, and prices were very, very good as well. So, you know, we got the double whammy there, so to speak, and it was like getting a free kick. It's like playing, going to the footy and getting a free kick, you know. You sort of, you got to make that kick really, really count well, and hopefully, you know, hopefully it goes to scoring a goal. But this year is a bit different, you know. We've certainly got the grain volume there. Pricing is a little bit poor, but it could be a lot worse, Belinda, but there's always money in volume. So, you know, as long as we've got the volume there and as long as everyone's got the volume there, hopefully we all should be okay.
Well, good to hear. You've had a good season. You finally finished. How do you celebrate?
I'm actually in Geraldton today getting some new tyres put on my ute and canopy's on, and we're off up the beach for a couple of weeks tomorrow. So just sit back, relax, suck in a bit of cool sea air and get the dust out of the lungs and, get ready to do it all again.
Rob, you enjoy it. Good to talk to you here on the Country Hour.
Thanks, Belinda. Been a pleasure.
Rob Kiddo, Mullewa farmer, off to the beach to enjoy the end of harvest. 19 past 12. Are you still harvesting? It'd be good to know who the very last person to finish this season is. Is that you? Let me know. 0448 922 604. And some interesting thoughts from Rob about the future of the CBH Group, the state's main grain handler. It is a cooperative. But he was a big fan of the cooperative structure. But he said a little further down the track, perhaps storage and handling should stay as is in terms of a cooperative. But maybe marketing and trading could be sold off as a listed company. What do you think of that? Let me know. 0448 922 604. 20 past 12.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
Prominent northern WA pastoralist Michael Thompson from Munda Station says he doesn't understand why the Pilbara's only live cattle loading ramp has been sold. Pilbara Ports sold the equipment, which was custom built in 2017, to Kimberley Ports last year for a nominal fee of $1. The last cattle vessel to call at Port Hedland was back in 2020. Michael Thompson says it would have made more sense to hang on to the asset for the future.
Look, I don't know why they would have sold that. I mean, was it eating grass? No. Was it going to deteriorate? No. I'm not sure. The problem with the Pilbara has been that we've been having a lot of dry runs and people have been forced to drop cow numbers, and of course that drops sale numbers going forward. So it hasn't been all beer and Skittles in the last 5 years, I reckon. Maybe over 10 years it's been, we've had a few hiccups along the journey. So to sell something like that, I just don't see the point of it. You know, it was there. If we could ever start stringing years together where we can get some consistency and everyone get some confidence back in the industry, and that would be getting their female numbers back up again, then the port would be handy. It's a cheap option for freight, trucking cattle to Perth like I am forced to do and a lot of others are forced to do. It's quite expensive compared to Port Hedland. You know, we're looking at, in the old days, 10 cents a kilo to go in through Hedland, and we're looking at 30 to come to Perth. So big difference.
Do you reckon this is the final nail in the coffin, Michael? Or, you know, do you reckon this signifies the end of the live cattle export out of the Pilbara?
Oh, I don't think, you know, live export will continue, but just maybe not out of Port Hedland. Look, Broome's only 600 k's from Munda. You know, I mean, it's not the end of the earth. I mean, it's still a saving. But, you know, Port Hedland, we've, you know, let's face it, you know, iron ore makes a lot of money and the priority is there, of course. And I get it. It makes our country a lot of money. But so do we, us cattle producers, not to the level of them, of course, but, you know, we're part of the game. I don't think a ship, you know, two or three ships a year was going to break the bank in Port Hedland. But, you know, in all fairness, you know, if we can't supply the cattle, enough cattle out there to fill a ship, what's the point in bringing them in? And I think that's where maybe it has got to. That confidence with the rainfall has dampened everyone's enthusiasm to a certain degree. And I guess this is where we're at today.
We're obviously thinking of our cattle producers in Queensland who are going through something no producer wants to, of course. There's nearly 30,000 heads of cattle dying in floodwaters over there. And I know that this hits close to home for you, Michael. What's been your reaction hearing what's going on over there?
It's sad. You know, look, it's heartbreaking. But I've, you know, I lost 2,000, well, over 6,000 cow herd that I run on Munda. You know, I lost 2019 through the same thing. Cyclone just sat over the top of us for 2 days and we went underwater. I didn't think anything had survived. I couldn't believe we actually had something left, but we lost a third of our weaners, a third of our calves, a third of our cows, and if they didn't die from drowning, they died from hypothermia. So it was sad, and I feel for them, but what can I do? There's so many things in life you can change, but you can't change nature. That's it. It's what they're getting beat up, and we've had our turn. And our turn will come again, I have no doubt. But my heart goes out to them. But I'm, you know, it's out of our hands. So all we can do is hope that this federal government and the Queensland government, I'm sure, are going to back them in and and get them going again. That's all you can hope.
How long did it take you to get back on your feet or to recover from those losses in 2019, Michael?
I don't think you ever do, but, you know, I started, you know, I usually keep about 800 heifers a year to replace my cow herd over a 10-year program, and I started keeping 1,500, so I was keeping genetics that I normally wouldn't have kept because of their quality probably wasn't good enough to keep. Well, you know, you're trying to keep your elite, and I guess a lot of pastoralists in that area will be forced to keep a lot of females that they would prefer not to, but to get their breeding herd back up, they'd probably do that. But, of course, that costs you money because you'd be selling those females as well. So financially you're getting bitten on the ass by having to keep them instead of sell them. And then, of course, the quality of your herd comes back a notch or two because you're keeping females to breed from that you normally wouldn't. So, and their losses, you know, look, to produce a cow takes you 3 years from the day it's conceived to actually put another calf on the ground. So it's a long time, and yeah, it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of expense.
I know when there's these sorts of mass stock losses, cattle producers in neighbouring states or territories often get tapped on the shoulder to help out. I know that we're not neighbouring with Queensland, but have you as a Pilbara producer been in touch with any Queensland producers, or have they gotten in contact with you to try and help fill the gap that has been left by these cattle losses?
Not at this stage, but I would say going forward, their loss is someone else's gain. It's always the way in this industry. And, you know, look, we sell 2,000 females a year, and we do sell and probably another 1,000 down in our Gingin property. But they've got to lick their wounds, assess what's happened to them. Can they afford to buy females in, or can they breed back? You know, there's so many decisions farmers in Queensland are going to have to make, and I've been through it, so I know what they're going through. So you've really got to sit back, suck it up, and then look at all your options. And, you know, hopefully we can help them out with good quality genetics if that's what they're looking for. And, of course, it put pressure on buyers of cattle because they'll suck up some of those cattle that they'd buy. So I see a lift in, you know, this is all hypothetical, but you'd like to think we're all going to get a shot in the arm in the marketplace. So I'm not happy about it because I would rather those cattle were alive for those people. But, you know, if there's a benefit for every other farmer that hasn't been affected by it, you've got to say you take it while you can because it might be our turn next.
Munda Station owner Michael Thompson speaking to Amelia Searson. And Pilbara Port says the Port Hedland cattle run hadn't been used for over 5 years, so it was happy to hand over the equipment to Kimberley Port's operations in Broome. And it also says the export of live cattle out of the Pilbara would need a privately licensed quarantine staging yard, which is no longer operational in Port Hedland. It's 28 to 1. We'll check the weather right across Western Australia shortly, and then catching up with Phil Clark, who's the chair of Fish for All. It's a local advocacy group, and they're still convinced that there's still time and strong public support to overturn the state government's decision to ban commercial demersal fishing along a long stretch of the WA coast. We'll get to that shortly. 28 past 12. Jonathan Beale is here with the news headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. The search for a man allegedly involved in a firearms incident in the northern wheat belt has entered its third day. Police say there have been no sightings of 58-year-old Kenneth John Giles, who allegedly fled with a firearm after a shot was fired on a rural property north of Mullawar on Wednesday. A woman known to Mr. Giles was shot in the hand and taken to hospital for surgery. Police say they have expanded the search area. Police in Perth's north are cracking down on underage e-rideable users amid complaints of gangs riding around abusing members of the public. Operation Moorhead was launched on Monday, and police say three children aged 14, 15 and 16 have since been arrested and charged. Drones and unmarked police vehicles are supporting the operation. And the federal opposition leader says the Prime Minister should show some contrition for not having called a Commonwealth Royal Commission sooner. Anthony Albanese yesterday announced a federal inquiry into the Bondi terrorist attack following weeks of escalating pressure. Susan Lee has welcomed the announcements but says she'd also like to see Mr Albanese take some responsibility for taking so long to announce the inquiry. More news, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Jonathan, thank you so much for that update. It is 29 past 12. We'll get into the fishing discussion shortly. The future of demersal fishing with that ban in place now since the 1st of January. Jim from Geraldton has already texted through 0448 922 604 and says the fishing minister, Jackie Jarvis, must be thinking it's easier to deal with 40 professionals rather than 10,000 recreational fishermen. You're basically giving the professionals a one-year redundancy wage and completely disregarding the boat generations of knowledge and their whole life, like the Kimberley fisherman that was on yesterday and hasn't been treated fairly starting 18 years ago. Maybe fully buy out boat and equipment of those who want to leave. Otherwise, it's like saying, here's a year's rent, now leave your house and no one can live in this street now. Who will you sell your house to? Ask Jim. The text 0448 922 604. We'll get into that shortly and also head to Mount Barker just before the news at 1 o'clock. Yesterday, the wieners were going under the hammer. Today was the trade sale, so Terry Birkin along just before the news at 1 to go through that for you. In just a moment, off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Nine to one here on the Country Hour, making our way now to the Bureau of Meteorology to catch up with Angeline Prasad this afternoon. Ange, what's the story across the Southwest Land Division?
Good afternoon, Belle. Well, we've got a firm ridge of high pressure that's bringing in this much milder temperatures across the southern parts of the state, including the Southwest Land Division. So winds are a little bit fresh, but yeah, it's just really nice weather at the moment,
isn't it?
The ridge will move east from tomorrow, so we see a quick return of the west coast trough from later tomorrow, and that means a return of increased fire dangers. So elevated fire dangers, we are looking at fire dangers increasing to extreme through the Perth Hills tomorrow. Because the ridge is quite firm, as it moves east, the southeasterly winds become more easterly but remain quite windy. So the fire dangers tomorrow are more wind-driven. The temperatures do start to warm up from tomorrow, but it's just a trickle. It's really the wind that is driving those elevated fire dangers tomorrow. And those elevated fire dangers continue into Sunday as well. Now, with that west coast trough developing, we'll see some dry thunderstorms return tomorrow as well. It happens quite suddenly. We've had this, you know, really nice mild weather, but yes, a change in the weather pattern tomorrow. So tomorrow we'll see initially dry thunderstorms develop to the far north of the central wheat belt. So I'm really looking at areas just hugging the southern Gascoyne area. So essentially the area north of maybe north of Muckenbuddin, Beacon, Dalwallinu, sort of that area, we'll see dry thunderstorms tomorrow. And then the west coast trough deepens as the ridge continues to move east. In fact, we'll see a low pressure system develop within that west coast trough as it deepens on Saturday night into Sunday. So what that does is it continues to drag in a little bit more heat into the southwest, but also that the thunderstorm area becomes a bit more extensive. So covers much of the central wheat belt, the central west, and also most likely the northern parts of lower west. From Sunday onwards, we will continue to see those dry thunderstorms, but we'll also start to see a mix of wet thunderstorms. So it's going to be a mix of wet and dry thunderstorms. So some areas, I'm not going to see much rain, not going to forecast much rainfall, so just a millimeter or 2 millimeters, but some areas might see a little, start to see a little bit more. So as that west coast trough becomes more active, it does drag in moisture from further northwards. So as we progress into Monday, thunderstorms become quite widespread across much of the southwest land division. And again, the northern parts will see more drier thunderstorms, but the areas, especially the Great Southern, the Esperance region, and also the south coast, sort of through that Albany area, southeast coastal areas, could see rainfall getting up to that 5 to 10 millimeters. So the thunderstorms do moisten up as we progress into early next week. But yeah, initially they will start off dry. So tomorrow, mostly dry thunderstorms. And again, with that rainfall, probably up to a millimeter. And then they do moisten up a little bit on Sunday, but not by much, maybe a couple of millimeters, and then a little bit more as we progress into Monday. And then the thunderstorms do contract out of the Southwest Land Division on Tuesday, or at least contract to the far eastern parts east of Esperance, and maybe the far northeastern parts of the Central Reed Belt on Tuesday as a new ridge arrives. So we'll go back into a milder pattern just briefly next week. On Tuesday, sort of Monday into Tuesday, before we see heat and the West Coast trough return very quickly in the second half of next week.
And Ange, how are the temperatures across, well, particularly northern parts of the state, and then look into the eastern part of WA?
Yes, so we have seen this prolonged hot spell that has been bubbling for quite some time now. I know yesterday Exmouth reached 49 degrees Onslow reached 49 degrees, not Exmouth. It was the third hottest day on record for Onslow. So a lot of heat has been bubbling through central parts of the state. And currently, we do have a heatwave warning out for the Pilbara, the Gascoyne, the Goldfields, the North Interior and South Interior. Now, today and into tomorrow, we do see that heat easing a little bit. So temperatures, instead of reaching the mid to high 40s during the day, will probably be in the low to mid 40s. So that means we'll see that heatwave ease off a little bit, just by a little bit, over the next couple of days. But we do expect the heat wave conditions to build back again, especially through the interior, maybe the southern parts of the Kimberley. And this time the heat is expected to get worse. So we'll, instead of just seeing a severe heat wave, we'll see a return of severe to extreme heat wave conditions. And those heat wave conditions may extend back into the Pilbara, maybe the northern parts of the Gascoyne and southern interior as we progress into next week. So the heat doesn't really get flushed out over the next few days, maybe a temporary easing, but not really getting flushed out. Now, we have seen thunderstorm activity through the northern and central parts of the state. And tomorrow, we'll see dry thunderstorms return to the northern parts of the Gascoyne. We have seen seasonal thunderstorms continue across the Pilbara and through the Kimberley and also through the North Interior. But the thunderstorms in the Pilbara have been on the dry side, and they have triggered quite a few wildfires over the last few days. So there have been quite a number of wildfires that have started through lightning strikes through the district. And those thunderstorms are likely to continue. They do moisten up, as I mentioned, just like the moisten up in the Southwest Land Division heading into Sunday, into Monday. The thunderstorms through the Kimberley have had a little bit more moisture. So we've seen a little bit more rainfall with those thunderstorms, but we've also seen this, we call them squall lines. So you get this line of thunderstorms that develop across the eastern, southeastern parts of the Kimberley and progress west. So they do pack a punch. So there is a risk of damaging wind gusts, so risk of severe thunderstorms, especially through the Kimberley and maybe through parts of the interior over the next couple of days with those continental squall lines.
Ange, thank you for running through all those details for us. Appreciate it. 22 to 1. And there wasn't much in the terms of rainfall across the state in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, recording 5 millimetres and above in the Kimberley, Siddons Creek 7, and in the Pilbara, Mount Florence 15. And it looks like there were some light showers in parts of the southwest and south coast, but nothing over 5 mils across the entire southwest land division.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
A local advocacy group says there's still time and strong public support to overturn the state government's decision to ban commercial demersal fishing along a long stretch of the WA coast. The ban came into effect on the 1st of January in an effort to save some under-threat fish species from the brink of collapse. But the group Fish for All was formed late last year, and it represents fishermen, licence holders, processors, restaurants and retailers. And it says the science isn't accurate and doesn't reflect a true assessment of the stocks. Fish for All met with the Fisheries Minister, Jackie Jarvis, on December 29th to discuss the need for an independent review of the fish stocks. Yesterday on the Country Hour, the Minister shared her assessment of the meeting.
This science is already independently reviewed. It's internationally recognised as world-class science. They did say, however, they wanted another independent review of the science. I told them if they had someone they want to review the science, I was more than happy to meet with them. I haven't heard back from them yet as to a contact, as to who they want me to discuss that with. I mean, I had three representatives from Fish for All come and see me. You know, one party said that they would be fine if we just suspended fishing for 2 to 3 years while we worked this all out. But then another commercial fisher who was in that meeting said, again, his business couldn't financially survive for 2 or 3 years without any fishing. So the decision I've made is to actually make sure that we've triggered that payment so that we've got that compulsory buyout and we make sure that we give some certainty to those businesses. The reality is there is simply not enough fish.
Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis, 19 to 1. Phil Clark is the chair of Fish for All. Phil, it sounds like you went to the minister with mixed messages. How accurate is the minister's assessment of the meeting?
Yeah, well, she might not have fully understood exactly what we were talking about because she's mixed things up a little bit in terms of, first of all, is the, you know, the idea that we couldn't financially afford to keep going when we were fishing and we were asking about that in the WAFIC submission. What we were talking about there was actually not being viable, and that wasn't financially viable. It was viable in terms of time because the way that fishery was managed was by a number of hours that you'd fish. And if you keep on decreasing the number of hours, then you won't have enough time to actually go and catch the fish that you need to catch. So that's where something like a quota would work better. And yes, yeah, so there's just a little bit of a misunderstanding there about financial viability and actual just physical viability in terms of hours able to fish.
Isn't that your job, though, to be crystal clear about what you want when you organise a meeting with a minister?
Yeah, we were crystal clear. I made it crystal clear.
Okay. So what exactly are you calling for?
What we were asking for was an independent stock assessment, not an independent review of the science. And so what we mean by that is we want, you know, new data to be fed into those models, and then that's data that we can trust. Because what we're seeing on the water does not reflect what's in the reports from the current stock assessment. We've also had the most significant changes to commercial and recreational effort over those 3 years, but we haven't had a survey to see what impacts those have had. And from what we're seeing on the water, they've had a very positive impact because people are having record catches and, you know, recreational fishermen are going out there and finding it as easy as possible to catch fish. So that's what we call catch per unit effort. And catch per unit effort is at some of the highest that it's been in the past 10, 15 years.
Doesn't that look like that you're just searching for science to support your desire to keep fishing demersal stocks?
Not necessarily. I think, you know, we're looking for science to paint a true picture of what's out there and have a response to what we're seeing. If this science comes back and shows us the same results, we're going to completely understand that. It's not that we're trying to find something different to change the opinion. What we're trying to do is get the truth out there because currently what's being put out is nowhere near the truth. And anyone that goes out fishing recreationally or commercially knows that to be true. And it's really sad that we've had science and data that is somewhat manipulated to to get a result that leads to commercial fishing being closed. I mean, if you look at the results that are in these reports over the past, 15 years, the commercial sector has been under the target threshold that the department set that whole time until the last 2 years, where we got huge cuts and we've had great recruitment of pink snapper. So while, at the same time, the recreational sector being far over what they're meant to be catching. And the reality is we've been sharing this great resource for a long time, and we've had times in the past where we're catching, more fish than what we've got. So if we look after this stock and do a good job over the next few years to improve the stock levels, we can continue to share this resource.
Phil, how confident are you that the minister is going to re-look this, because the ban on demersal fishing along a long stretch of WA's coastline is already in play? It kicked in on the 1st of January, and now we're looking at compensation packages, finalising the details of that. I mean, isn't this sort of, the horse bolted?
I'm not too sure on that. At the end of the day, this hasn't been fully gone through Parliament yet, so there's still an opportunity there. But I think at the end of the day, when ministers and the government make certain decisions, there's times where the public get behind the idea being not the right thing to do, and that can create a positive effect. And what we're seeing through, submissions into our, petitions and all the support we're getting from the public is that the general public do not approve of what's happening. They do not approve of their fish stock being taken away and their ability to access that fish being taken away. Because if you're not a recreational fisher, the way that you access that fish is through a commercial fisherman. So people want to see local fish on their menus at restaurants. They want to be able to go to the fish and chip shop, get local fish, and go to fish retailers and get local fish. And if these things go through, that's not going to happen. So, yeah, I think the public's right behind us. They want to keep their resource, and those are the kind of things that influence ministers.
This is the Country on the ABC right across Western Australia. And Phil Clark is here today. He's the chair of a group called Fish for All, and he also is the owner of a company called Finn's Seafood. It owns fishing licences, a wholesale business, retail outlets and a restaurant. Phil, what impact is this decision, this ban on demersal fishing, going to have on your business?
Well, the real impact is that we're not going to have as much local fish supply. So we're having to source that from, other areas. Some of that at the moment, we're trying to keep it as close to home as possible. We're really looking into New Zealand, so bringing a bit of fish from New Zealand. But even, South Australia, Tasmania, Sydney, Queensland, across Australia, we're going to be trying to drag into that. Problem with that is everyone's still fighting over that fish across Australia. So prices are going to go up, and we're seeing, quite significant increases to the prices that we're charging the general public and restaurants.
How much have the prices moved? Can you give us an example?
It's about 30%, 30 to 40% is where it's gone up. I mean, but some of the fish, we were looking at the price sheet the other day, and, the fish that we would need to charge $140 a kilo for, being coral trout, was the one that we'd make the lowest amount of margin. So, at some point, people aren't going to want to go out and spend $140 on a piece of coral trout, and so you're just not going to be able to sell it. So it's definitely concerning there.
When are you likely to run out of local supplies? I mean, you're looking at accessing, trying to source that fish almost immediately. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I don't think you're necessarily going to run out. Just the supply each week is going to be decreased. So these changes and these bans have got an effective of about 60 tonnes a week of fish that we're not getting landed into Western Australia. So let's say, 45 tonnes of that would stay local. So we've got to replace 45 tonnes a week or something to that effect. So some of that might be from local fish where we're maybe eating a little bit more mullet or herring or something to that effect, but some of that's going to have to come from the East Coast and international. So I think, there'll be a lot more Indonesian, New Zealand, fish like that coming through the market.
Phil, good to get an update from you. Thank you.
Thanks. See you later.
Phil Clark, who's chair of Fish for All and the owner of Finn's Seafood, he's pretty confident that the state government will backflip on this decision to ban commercial demersal fishing along that stretch of WA coast. Are you confident too? What do you think? This on the text from Lincoln in Busselton, who says it's just a vote-buying exercise at the expense of the livelihoods of all people involved in the fishing industry. Just so happens that the ban ends just before the next election. Who would have thought? The text 0448 922 604. It is 11 minutes to one. One of Australia's largest family-owned marine towage companies has sold in Esperance. Mackenzie Marine and Towage was established over 50 years ago and was purchased by Spain's Beluda Towage in December. But operations will continue to be led locally by the Mackenzie family. For Fudd Mackenzie, whose dad started the business, this has been a time for reflection and putting pen to paper to write a book about his early years and experience as a former mariner, fisherman and tugboat captain.
The first boat that I was actually able to take out was we had a little a little wooden dinghy. It was only like less than 3 metres long. It was 2.5 metres long that Dad had built. Dad was very handy with his hands, of course, and we're building wooden things, and he'd already built a couple of boats. And he built us a little dinghy of the kids so you could row it. And then later on he put a sail on it so you could sail it. And that was how I got into sailing. But I guess that I do remember taking that out by myself and with other friends. So that's probably the first time that I was by myself in a boat. Yes, yeah, no doubt about that, yeah.
The fishing side of things, there was the tourism or the burgeoning tourism, and then there was the tugs. What was your preference? What did you like the most?
Oh, I think I liked fishing. Driving a tug is an amazing experience, as anybody who has ever done it tell you. It really is. It's once you master that, it's a pretty amazing experience. But I think the thrill of catching fish and see, we were shark fishing mostly in those days. It was hard work, but yeah, no, I did enjoy it. But then tuna came along, and man, that was exciting. That was, yeah, that was adrenaline pumping. You know, we all ended up with arms like Popeye, as I say, because we were pretty fit. We had to be pretty fit, yeah.
So you've seen some big changes, especially to the fishing side of things, but over that time. How are you feeling looking at the South Coast Marine Park that's been proposed and will be in play in the coming few months? I mean, how does that leave you?
Well, I guess I've always been a bit of a greenie of the family. I have, definitely. I'm if you say a greenie, I mean, I'm not a greenie, right? But I am very conservation-minded. Of all the family, I'm probably, when I think of my brothers and all the rest, I'm the probably more vocal one. And I think the Marine Park is a fantastic idea, all right? And I think that there is a little bit of pain there. I don't think it's much. And I think that now that what's happened on the West Coast with the fishery over there, which is a terrible thing and people are being treated terribly, but it's got to be done because there's no choice and we do not want to end up like here. So by putting it into a marine park status, we hope, and this hasn't come to fruition, we hope we start to get some serious research done down here, not only on the physical side, but on the fishing side as well. And I know a marine park's supposed to not have anything to do with the fishing, but it really does, because it's all part and parcel of the whole thing. So I'm pretty keen to think that the future's going to be fairly rosy down here because of that.
What about the future of the business that your dad started, that you guys worked together as brothers, and now is obviously in that the hands of the third generation?
Well, 2 weeks ago, the tug business was actually sold, and that's gone to an international operator. I guess that was inevitable because tugs are just worth too much money, you know, and you've got to have the finances to back it because you do have to have new machinery and all the rest of it. And that's what we've always done, is try to have good new equipment and things like that. Yeah, and at the end of the day, it was a family decision that was made by all of us as to where do we want to go. And it's not bittersweet. It's like, I think it was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to happen now. Yeah, I think that my father would have gone, yep, nah, that's fine. You know, if that's what's happened to the company. And I mean, at the end of the day, we've left the legacy of over 50 years here, being the people here. That's not going to go forever. Nothing goes forever. So yeah, it's I try not to think of it as being sad. I don't really, no.
Fudd Mackenzie speaking to Tara de Langraft, and Fudd's book, Salt Water in My Veins, is going to be launched at the Esperance Bay Yacht Club tonight, 7 to 1. The new CEO of the National Farmers Federation says a strong single voice to Parliament on important issues is vital for the future of the sector. Michael Gurin is the former CEO of Queensland's peak farm body AgForce and has recently been acting as the CEO at New South Wales Farmers. He replaces the NFF's previous CEO, Troy Williams, who left the role in July after just 4 months in the job. Michael Gurin says he's thrilled to get the job.
Look, I'm in my late 50s, have been incredibly proud to represent producers over the last 9 odd years and to be given the chance, and I would describe it as a privilege of representing producers across the nation in the NFF role is something I'm very humbled and honoured to have been offered. I chased it hard and I'm very lucky to have got the role. There is an incredibly urgent need for producers' voices to be better heard in decision-making corridors in the federal parliament. And what the NFF is a National Farmers Federation, a federation of members, an organisation that can unite industry and ensure we have a strong single voice on important issues like trade, like policy settings around, for example, the EPBC Act, where there's a really important conversation going on at the moment. And if you look at, for example, the economics of farming from a young person's perspective, you take the costs of buying land, the costs of capital, and you put across that the imposition of risk that goes with capital and farming, there's no profitability left in a game where we need to be attracting young people in, and where we know that if we can attract young people in, then the Australian farming system can support regional communities, support social infrastructure, support better environmental outcomes, and give us that peace and prosperity, should I say, that food security gives us.
Let's just quickly talk about something you brought up there was the need for unity and I guess and stability in a sense. Last year for the NFF, it wasn't maybe the easiest times for the organisation on that front. Let's start with the obvious. The previous CEO only lasted 4 months in the role. Seems like there's a need for stability at the top of the organisation right now. Are you going to be able to provide that?
I certainly plan to. There is a need for stability, for leadership, for strength, and for unity. And unity doesn't mean one organisation. Unity means all the organisations that represent producers in various ways working together, recognising the strength of that united voice. And yes, the NFF family has gone through some changes and challenges in the recent past. I've been a part of that as a member of the Federated Family in my role at AgForce and more latterly at the New South Wales Farmers, some tough conversations going on. But being in those conversations, what I also know is you have a room full of people who are dedicated to a better future for an industry where they really understand the upside and the opportunity for Australia and getting it right, who are committed to the cause, who give incredibly of their time and their intellect across, you know, committees, various elected roles, many hundreds of senior producers giving through different organisations in the NFF, through Members Council, etc. So a dedicated group going through a reasonably tough period, but all with an interest in best outcomes for producers and understanding the opportunity and recognising the value in working together and in unity. And the conversations have been tough, but it's going to end up in the right place.
Michael Gurin, he's the new CEO of the National Farmers Federation. He was speaking to Charles Geary and he starts the role on March 23rd. 3 minutes to one. To Mount Barker now. We're at Mount Barker yesterday to get the results of the wiener sale. Today it is the trade sale. A total of 431 yarded today. That's down by 299 on the last sale for 2025. Terry Birkin, can you run through the details?
Hi Belinda. Suppliers were light at Mount Barker for the first Friday trade sale of 2026 with 431 head. Yielding calves were in fair and quality and gained 5 to 10 cents a kilo over both steers and heifers. And a good lineup of grown heifers and a quality run of cows saw values recover from the last sale's loss in values. Yielding steers weighing over 400 kilos sold from 338 cents to 432 cents. And yielding heifers in the same weight class made 346 to 402 cents a kilo. Lighter yielding steers were selling from 340 cents to 410 cents, while the lighter heifers rose from 280 cents to 398 cents a kilo. Grown steers up to 500 kilos returned 368 to 372 cents, and over 500 kilos made from 364 to 368 cents a kilo. Grown heifers under 540 kilos were selling from 318 to 370 cents, and heavy heifer sold from 335 to 358 cents a kilo. The few stall cows yarded made 250 cents to 280 cents, while medium weights and heavyweight cows were similar in cents per kilo, ranging from 286 to 340 cents, and heavy bulls returned 300 cents to 332 cents a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Terry, thank you for going through those details. A minute and a half away from the news at 1 o'clock. A few texts to get through. Bob Ifler has texted through on the future of CBH, saying we need to retain CBH as a cooperative. To sell off parts of CBH is like selling off parts of our farm. We, like CBH, would soon become less profitable. We need to stop talking about corporatisation. And this on the fishing issue, this from Jim. Again, like farming, suddenly politicians know more about sheep. Now they know more about fishing. Next time you need fishing information, don't ask a fisherman. Why would you when you can ask a politician? And this from Di in Bunbury. The minister is off the planet. She's not thinking things through. An account is there, according to all fishermen. It's got to stop. All the industry people going completely broke is so wrong. Good to talk to you today. Thanks for all your contributions too. On the ABC right across WA, the news, the 1 o'clock news, is next.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.